Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at From Beyond from 1986. Adapted by Stuart Gordon, Brian Usna, and Dennis Paoli from a short story by H.P. Lovecraft, and directed by Stuart Gordon. Obviously, out of all that, the short story is the obvious place to start, and that means talking about a man I've been tiptoeing around for 140 episodes now, influential author and creator of the cosmic horror subgenre, H.P. Lovecraft. Lovecraft was born in Rhode Island in 1890 to an affluent family, but by 1904 the family fortune had been lost to a series of misfortunes. This was prior to the era of most financial regulations, and stock panics could wipe out entire businesses in a matter of hours, leaving him financially insecure for most of his adult life. With few marketable skills and significant anxieties and neuroses that prevented him from holding down a traditional job, he turned to writing to make ends meet. Most of his short stories were published in Weird Tales, a magazine from the era that launched the careers of Robert E. Howard, Clark Ashton Smith, and Robert Bloch, and featured a few recurring themes. As a virulent racist and xenophobe, Lovecraft harbored an obsession with the intermingling of the various racial groups, what he would have called miscegenation, although thankfully that particular term has been more or less lost to history, and with the notion that society has been in a perpetual state of decline from a long-vanished golden age where the superior races planned and designed great marvels that the lesser races would then build with their slave labor. Basically your typical ancient aliens theorizing, taking as its central premise that a race of people with darker skin couldn't possibly have been responsible for something as impressive as, say, the pyramids, and working backwards to explain why. But in addition to his obsessive fears of the outsider and his even more obsessive fear of eroding the boundaries between the self and the outsider, I've heard it suggested, although I can't remember where, that Lovecraft's own worries about his father's side of the family tree led to him writing The Shadow over Innsmouth, Lovecraft also cultivated a unique viewpoint in his stories that would become his legacy to horror. He imagined that we live in a universe not good, not evil, but indifferent to the entire human race, filled with entities so powerful and ancient and vast that their merest accidental shrug could wipe out our entire species. This brand of existential nihilism, combined with the dread of being so far beyond our comprehension that even trying to understand them could destroy human mind, became known first as Lovecraftian horror, and later as cosmic horror once it became obvious just how uncomfortably racist he truly was, and people wanted to distance the subgenre from its creator. And just to debunk a commonly repeated myth about Lovecraft, he was not just a product of his time. Yes, racism was profound and prevalent in the 1920s and 30s when he was most active as a writer, but that was also the era of the Harlem Renaissance when writers like W.E.B. Du Bois and Zora Neale Hurston were writing powerful and cogent critiques of the construction of race that are still being taught in literary criticism studies to this day. Du Bois is the man who wrote the famous phrase, "All art is propaganda and ever must be," and he wrote it for a speech in 1926. This wasn't some magical era before it occurred to anyone that black people might be human beings. Lovecraft chose to isolate himself with bigotry and hate against other races and immigrants and anyone who wasn't a lily-white Easterner, and it's important to recognize that truth because it informs his entire writing, and an intelligent critique of Lovecraft requires unpicking that legacy of racism from the other aspects of his work. After his death in 1937 from intestinal cancer at the age of 46, his literary estate wound up the subject of a struggle between Lovecraft's chosen executor, R.H. Barlow, and Lovecraft superfan August Derleth. Derleth won, primarily out of sheer stubbornness, and proceeded to publish a formal collection of what he called the Cthulhu Mythos, the corpus of Lovecraft's works of cosmic horror, through his own imprint Arkham House. These versions contain some controversial editing and even some additional stories written by Derleth, but credited in whole or in part to Lovecraft, that systematized and formalized the pantheon of all-powerful entities that Lovecraft created for his stories. The mythos became commonly accepted by horror fans, propagated by heavy metal bands and colleagues of Lovecraft that Derleth encouraged to write stories set within the fictional universe he'd created, and by the 1980s that was even further formalized into a system by the tabletop role-playing game Call of Cthulhu, because there's nothing that systematizes a genre quite like creating rules for it. Look at D&D and fantasy. All of which leads us to, 1985. Because there's no easy way around it. This is the second in a cycle of Lovecraft adaptations from Stuart Gordon, and I'm doing it first because I like it more, but you can't really get into the movie's production history without talking about 1985's Reanimator. That was the product of producer Charles Band, who has shepherded over 400 genre movies into existence over the course of his long and checkered career, virtually all of them containing at least some degree of gloriously trashy schlock of one kind or another. This was in his Empire International Pictures phase, when he was still releasing movies for theatrical distribution, but when Empire collapsed, he'd become far more famous for his direct-to-video distribution company, Full Moon Entertainment. If you've heard of the seemingly endless Trancer, Subspecies, Puppet Master, Baby Oopsie, Evil Bong, Ginger Dead Man, or Demonic Toys series of movies, you know who Charles Band is. Although even that doesn't scratch the surface of his whole wild career. He also made the Ghoulies movies, Creepazoid, Sorority Babes in the Slimeball Bowl-O-Rama, Robot Holocaust, Troll, Terror Vision, you know, that movie I keep saying I'm going to do someday alongside The Premature Burial, and the infamous cult classic Tourist Trap with its twist that must be seen to be believed. Cinema would be significantly less weird without him. Band got together with Stuart Gordon, a director with a reputation for challenging and provocative stage presentations. How provocative? His first production involved locking the audience in with the actors and dragging planted performers up on stage to beat them up. The two of them were both big fans of Lovecraft, and they decided to adapt a cycle of Lovecraft adaptations similar to the way Roger Corman adapted the works of Edgar Allan Poe, starting with Reanimator. When that was an unexpected hit, Roger Ebert even gave it 3 stars, they came back the next year using many of the same cast members. Gordon's theater background informed this choice, as he liked working with people who were used to his style and the aesthetic he was aiming for, to do From Beyond. Gordon worked with his Reanimator collaborators Brian Usna and Dennis Paoli, both prolific screenwriters in their own right, and in the case of Usna, a talented director as well, to expand the rather brief 7-page story Lovecraft wrote into a complete feature script. An absolute murderer's row of special effects artists was then recruited to turn the concept art of holy shit, Neil fucking Adams? Okay, that sentence was going to end with into reality and mention the names of the FX artists who worked on the production, but can we just take a moment to fucking nerd out over the fact that Neil Adams, aka the definitive Batman artist, the guy whose artwork they still use to this day on all the licensed merchandise for the character, aka also the guy who did the Hard Trucking Heroes era of Green Lantern, aka one of the most visionary and influential artists on the X-Men comics, aka the tireless creator's rights advocate who secured a pension for Superman creator Siegel and Schuster, aka the most famous advocate of the bizarre and pseudoscientific expanding Earth hypothesis, that Neil Adams did the concept art for this movie? How did I never know this until just now? It does make sense, though. One of the other stage productions Gordon did back when he was a theater director was a trilogy of plays called Warp, about an ordinary man who discovers he's actually a cosmic superhero named Lord Cumulus. Adams was the art director for the production, a natural fit given his background in comics, and the two of them must have worked well together because he asked Adams to do sketches for both this film and Dolls. So that's, amazing. Seriously, it's like being a fan of horror and architecture and finding out that Frank Lloyd Wright did the set design for Voodoo Man or something. But getting back to that murderer's row of effects talent, we have John Vulick, who worked on Day of the Dead and Night of the Living Dead, as well as over 100 episodes of Babylon 5 and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, each. We have Mark Sjostrom, who worked on Phantasm 2, Evil Dead 2, A Nightmare on Elm Street 2 and 3, and Videodrome, among many others. We have Greg Nicotero and Robert Kurtzman, only a year before they do Evil Dead 2 together and form their own company with Howard Berger. And we have the late, great John Carl Buechler, future director of Friday the 13th Part 7, and effects and makeup artist on everything from Halloween 4 to Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. If you were to toss in Burger, Screaming Mad George, and Tom Savini, I think you'd practically fill out a bingo card of great effects artists of the 1980s. And I haven't even gotten to the cast yet. In the lead role of Crawford Tillinghast, we have the iconic Jeffrey Combs, who we last talked about in the episode on 1996's The Frighteners. And while he was great there, this and the Reanimator series really defined the man's reputation for absolute commitment to the most outrageous characters, and led to decades of casting in genre film and television everywhere from Babylon 5 and several different Star Trek TV shows, to cult and quirky horror productions like The Attic Expeditions, to voice work in cartoons where he played, among other things, H.P. Lovecraft. He is a true idol of the genre who's still working today. I think I kind of have to see his recent movie Onyx the Fortuitous and the Talisman of Souls. And we also have the legendary Barbara Crampton as Dr. Catherine McMichaels, who we last discussed in the context of the film Jacob's Wife, and who is also in Onyx the Fortuitous and the Talisman of Souls, but who's become, in her own words, the Betty White of horror, still cruising from one horror hit to another as she fully embraces the love and respect genre fans have been holding for her since the 1980s. She went from being an ingenue in films like Reanimator and Chopping Mall, to a character actor in movies like You're Next and Lords of Salem, and now she's producing her own projects like the recent Joe Lynch film Suitable Flesh. And she's just the kindest, sweetest, most gracious and charming of any celebrity I've ever seen on social media. One person we haven't discussed before on this podcast is Ted Sorrell, who plays Dr. Edward Pretorius. That's because Sorrell didn't do a ton of horror apart from this movie and Basket Case 2 in 1990. He was a day player and guest actor in a number of television shows in the 80s and 90s, including Matlock, Hardcastle and McCormick, and Scarecrow and Mrs. King. His last television role was in 1996 in Mad About You, and he passed away in 2010. We've absolutely talked about our fourth main character, though. It's the great Ken Foree as police officer Bubba Brownlee, coming in hot off years of guest appearances in television shows from The Dukes of Hazzard and Hill Street Blues and Remington Steele and The A-Team, as well as movies like George Romero's Knight Riders and the Richard Pryor vehicle JoJo Dancer Your Life is Calling. Of course, we remember him as Peter from Dawn of the Dead. This came right at the beginning of his turn into embracing genre, and he'd go on to be in Terror Squad, Death Spa, Phantom of the Mall, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, and on up to his recent films The Midnight Man and The Rift, Dark Side of the Moon. And playing a small but significant role as the odious Dr. Block, a nod to Lovecraft's circle of friends and collaborators, is Carolyn Purdy Gordon, who is Stuart Gordon's longtime wife as well as collaborator, a fact that I absolutely knew right from the beginning and didn't edit in later after finding it out from the Dead Meat podcast, and who worked on the play Bleacher Bums with Dennis Paoli and Stuart Gordon, and wound up 6 years later in the horror movie they did as well. She also appeared in a number of other Charles Band productions, including Reanimator, Dolls, Robot Jocks, The Pit and the Pendulum, Fortress, Castle Freak, and Space Truckers. I assume Charles Band must be a blast to work for, because nobody acts in his movies to get rich and nobody acts in them to get famous, but lots of people come back again and again to be in another one of his productions. And because the main cast for this one is pretty small, let's go ahead and dig right in. It should be noted, by the way, that the DVD I found is the unrated director's cut, which includes some of the footage hacked out to appease the MPAA and avoid the dreaded X rating. This footage was thought lost for many years, but was saved by editor Lee Percy and found sometime later. The trims were workprint quality, not full negatives, but film technicians lovingly restored it using modern technology and saved the movie in the format it was always intended to be seen. As a gorehound, my undying thanks go to everyone who worked hard to give us the true experience Stuart Gordon created in all its lurid neon glory. And speaking of, the movie opens almost in medias res, with Crawford Tillinghast typing away at a fine example of 80s computing technology as he prepares to fire up the Resonator, a massive piece of equipment that looks like a pillar surmounted by four giant tuning forks, all surrounded by the requisite banks of controls and monitoring displays. As soon as the device begins operating, everything is suffused with a neon magenta glow that's got notes of pink, purple, and blue to it. Basically, if you're familiar with the term bisexual lighting, this movie has it in resplendent abundance, even though it came out decades before anyone gave the concept a formal definition. Crawford presses his fingers to his forehead for a moment as the resonator begins to resonate, exactly where the third eye would be in both the Hindu and Buddhist mystical traditions. And as with the tulpa, which we've mentioned on occasion in this podcast, this concept was stolen wholesale by the Theosophists for their own pseudo-religious cult and combined with a heavy dose of dodgy pseudoscience. According to them, and yes, this is relevant, the Buddhists and Hindus only thought of the third eye as a spiritual eye of wisdom because they lacked the scientific understanding to realize it was actually the site of the pineal gland, which is a dormant sensory organ. It actually does function in that capacity in some species of reptile to regulate circadian rhythms through light sensitivity, but in humans it really just produces hormones. The Theosophists, though, thought it could be reactivated through force of will, and although this is exactly the kind of thing Houdini railed against in his efforts to debunk the movement, it is going to be extremely important to this story in particular. Lovecraft famously ghost wrote a story for Houdini, which is why that connection is significant here. Back to the film, a 2-foot-long magenta eel shimmers into existence as the resonator revs up, swimming through thin air as if it was water, and although Crawford is initially fascinated by the strange and alien lifeform, his wonder soon becomes terror when it bites him on the cheek in a spirited attempt to gouge a chunk out of him. One difference from the Lovecraft story, in the original the lesser creatures weren't dangerous at all, and the real threat came from attuning too closely to the immaterial planes and seeing things humans were never meant to perceive. Crawford manages to disconnect the resonator, causing the thing to vanish again, and I think this was about as far as I got with this movie the first time I saw it, because my dad walked in on me and decided for whatever reason that this was a piece of trash and I needed to turn it off immediately. I think half the reason the film stuck in my mind for so many years was the inherent injustice of not being allowed to find out what happened next. Shaken and horrified, Crawford goes to get his mentor, Dr. Pretorius, a character who's not in the original story and who's named after Victor Frankenstein's partner in scientific mayhem in the 1935 film Bride of Frankenstein. Pretorius isn't initially interested in having his debauched and lecherous entertainment interrupted, but when Crawford tells him he got the resonator up and running, Pretorius comes out wearing nothing but a silk robe to take a look. Originally, we were supposed to see here that his form of entertainment involved giving a woman a tongue piercing with a hammer and nail, but that footage was snipped before the film even went to the MPAA and was lost forever. We will be talking about this movie's treatment of BDSM and kink, though, I absolutely assure you. Pretorius fires up the resonator again because some folks don't learn from other people's mistakes, and when he turns it up to full strength, both he and Crawford feel the same throbbing sensation inside their skulls where the third eye would be. But Pretorius isn't frightened of what's happening. He welcomes the opening of his mind to new senses and seems almost thrilled by the prospect that the resonator might be attracting the attention of beings beyond our normal five senses' ability to perceive. Meanwhile, the next-door neighbor, played by Bunny Summers, a charming character actor who parlayed her brassy voice and boisterous attitude into a whole career of playing busybodies and kvetches, is calling the cops about the colored lights and the weird sounds again. Her dog, which is named Bunny in a very cute inside joke, goes running for the house, and when she runs after it, she finds it scratching at the door to the attic just before Crawford chops his way out of the room with an axe. She thinks he's chasing her down the stairs, but he runs right past her and clean out of the house, where he's arrested by the arriving police. They have amazing response times in this neighborhood. I'm really impressed. But Bunny didn't leave with them, and as we cut back to the fluffy little poodle, it's nibbling gently at the stump of Dr. Pretorius's neck where his body lies on the floor. There is a significant absence of anything above it, which is a lovely way to finish up the cold open as the title card drops. I love a movie that lets you know exactly what you're getting into right from the beginning, and this is already just so weird and trippy and horny and lurid and perverse that I kind of think I'm required by law to love it. I may be giving away a bit of my plans for the DVD at the end here. Now, in the original short story, this is pretty much it. The names and details have gotten changed around a little, but what you see is what you get. Scientist A shows off his new machine that can expand the sensory horizons beyond understanding to Scientist B. Scientist B freaks out and wrecks the machine. Forces outside of human reckoning kill Scientist A. Oh, and Scientist A knew what would happen if it was switched on, since he'd already lost a few servants that way, and he wanted Scientist B to die as revenge for not supporting him emotionally when he was on his way to the big breakthrough. So everything we're about to get is a lovely expansion of the initial idea that comes about simply by asking, yes, but what would happen next? And what happens next, as we come out of the opening credits, is that Crawford is committed to a mental institution until it can be determined whether he's fit to stand trial for the murder of Dr. Pretorius. Because, I mean, he was found with an axe and a headless body, and that doesn't usually point to an unfortunate but unavoidable mishap, you know? The psychiatrist brought in to evaluate him is Dr. Catherine McMichaels, and it's worth noting at least briefly that she's not there to lay the groundwork for an insanity defense. She's there to determine whether Crawford is going to be competent to participate in his own defense at all. See, there are two kinds of quote-unquote insanity in the judicial system, only one of which really gets talked about much in the media, but this is a rare example of the other kind, so I'll briefly get into it. Most people know about the insanity defense, the concept that a person can be found not guilty of a crime by virtue of being unable to distinguish between right and wrong at the time they committed it. Note that you can be mentally ill and still not be able to benefit from the insanity defense. I stole this mannequin because I felt a compulsion to bring it home and dress it up in my late wife's clothes is not insanity in the eyes of the law because you still knew you were committing a crime. Well, I stole this mannequin because I thought it was my late wife and she'd been kidnapped and placed in a display window is potentially insanity because you legitimately didn't have the conceptual framework to understand that what you were doing was a crime and not a rescue. But there's another kind of mental health issue the court recognizes, which is whether the defendant is mentally competent to stand trial. If the accused is currently dealing with a mental health condition serious enough to prevent them from being able to understand the proceedings and play a role in their own defense, the judge, the prosecutor, or the defense attorney can order a competency hearing, which Catherine is laying the groundwork for here, to ensure the defendant knows what's happening to them and can make required decisions related to the case. Being found incompetent isn't the same as being found insane. If you're found incompetent, you're still under arrest, and the charges have yet to be judged. But you'll be remanded to a mental health facility for treatment until you're deemed fit to stand trial, at which point everything resumes as normal. Assuming that ever happens. I found out about all this from Michael Greenberg's book on George Metesky, better known as the Mad Bomber, who planted 33 bombs in the city of New York over the course of 15 years. Metesky was found unfit to stand trial, as he planned to claim as his defense that he was merely bringing attention to the unfair actions of the electric company Consolidated Edison and was thus perfectly justified in his crimes, and so he was remanded to the Matteawan Hospital for the Criminally Insane for treatment. He wasn't released until 1973, when the Supreme Court ruled that committing mentally ill defendants without a jury decision on their danger to the public unconstitutionally deprived them of their liberty without due process. By that time, Metesky had served over two-thirds of the maximum sentence he could have gotten for his crimes, his bombs injured several people but never killed anyone, without his case ever having seen the inside of a courtroom, and he'd been a model prisoner all that time. Being inside the mental health system can be far more terrifying than going to jail. But to get back to Crawford, he's facing exactly that kind of situation unless Catherine finds him mentally competent. Luckily, she's against the idea of carceral institutionalization, something she's quick to mention to the hospital's chief of staff, Dr. Block. Block in turn mentions that she's against using the mentally ill in potentially unethical psychological experiments, which tells us a lot about Catherine's reputation within the medical community, and together the two of them go in to see Crawford. Incidentally, I just want to give a special shout out to the costume department here, specifically wardrobe master Sergio Ballo and wardrobe coordinator Fabrizio Caracciolo. The whole movie was shot in Italy with a local crew to save money, as you might have guessed from those names, because Barbara Crampton was fairly young when she took this role, only 28, and there was probably a temptation to dress her in outfits that accentuated her sexuality. But because she needed to plausibly appear as an authority on mental health, they gave her a stylish but very professional outfit that allowed Crampton to perform without undercutting the character she was trying to present. I call that kind of undercutting Christmas Jones syndrome, after the nuclear physicist in a James Bond movie who was given a silly name and constantly dressed in skimpy, sexy outfits that made it impossible for actor Denise Richards to be taken seriously in the role. Catherine is clearly upset by the plight of the patients as she walks down the halls. As I mentioned way back in my episode on Friday the 13th, A New Beginning, this was an era where people were finally recognizing that carceral institutionalization of the mentally ill, particularly of schizophrenics, often did more harm than good, even if the alternative plan of outpatient treatment wound up leaving a lot of them without a support network and falling through the cracks. But in Catherine's case, it's more than professional sympathy, as we'll eventually discover. She's finally led into Crawford's room, where he's curled up in a corner looking desperately miserable. Crawford finally gets the chance to deliver some exposition, explaining that Pretorius built the resonator to stimulate the dormant pineal gland, which is pronounced almost universally in this movie as pineal, in order to create a sixth sense that would allow us to perceive a world ordinarily invisible to human understanding. But the resonator also allowed the teeming denizens of that world to perceive us, and when one of them saw Pretorius, it, quote, bit off his head like a gingerbread man. That's about enough for Block, who has Crawford restrained and sedated, but Catherine wants to dig a little deeper. She runs a CAT scan on Crawford, who's not exactly thrilled at the notion of being placed into a large machine after what he's been through, and discovers that Crawford's pineal gland is in fact enlarged and growing out of the front of his brain. Block assumes that he might have a brain tumor that's causing hallucinations, which isn't unreasonable under the circumstances, but Purdy Gordon does an amazing job of making her character unlikable even when she's right, and Catherine suggests to Jordan Fields, the assistant to the district attorney who's played by Bruce McGuire, that the only way to be sure is to rebuild the resonator Crawford destroyed with the axe and see what it actually does. Block, who again is absolutely right about a lot of things, but whose performance is so convincingly obnoxious that you feel like she ought to be wrong, says that it's highly unethical to force a mentally ill man to relive his traumatic experience and that Catherine is more interested in burnishing her reputation than in helping her patient. But Fields has too many unanswered questions to be able to simply write Crawford off as a schizophrenic, and I like that he specifically mentions the things he can't explain, like the lack of blood on the axe, rather than simply trying to stitch up Crawford for the murder and call it a day. He remands the patient to Catherine's custody and orders them to go back to the Pretorius house to repair the machine and test the dead man's theories. Crawford, presented with the choice between life in a mental institution and risking his existence by repairing the resonator, reluctantly decides to help. He leaves the facility and meets his new warden, former football player and current police sergeant Buford Bubba Brownlee, who's cheerful and friendly and inadvertently sexist when he assumes Crawford to be Dr. McMichaels. But he's quick to accept correction, and together the three of them head back to the Pretorius house to get started. And I mean, this is where you really understand how vital Combs is to the success of this movie, and why this cycle of Lovecraft adaptations absolutely made his career. There are so many shots here that are just close-ups of his anguished, terrified face as they roll up to the house and go inside, and he is straight up giving a clinic on how to present larger-than-life emotions without being silly or campy. You legit get the feeling that he's like an animal in a trap, tempted to chew his own leg off to escape the situation he's been caught in, and every time the camera's on him, he is resolutely fascinating. It's not the same kind of leading man charisma that Tom Hanks has exactly, but you do kind of get the feeling that Combs could steal scenes from even the most A-list actor. They enter the house, which is 666 Benevolent Street, and I assume Pretorius bought it off a listing in Ironically Appropriate Real Estate Monthly, and Crawford almost immediately slips away in the darkness. Bubba gets the power back on using the breakers in the basement, and they begin to explore the house looking for Crawford, only to find that Pretorius had an entire BDSM dungeon on the second floor and made videotapes of his scenes with much younger women. Bubba is a little judgy, as you might expect from a vanilla dude in the 80s, but Catherine says she's not interested in the dead man's private life, and they continue their search. They eventually find Crawford in the attic, planning to take an axe to the resonator and smash it to bits once and for all, but Bubba quickly disarms him and Catherine realizes he's in the grip of a post-traumatic flashback. Once he snaps back to himself, he's ready to get to work repairing the device. The work continues well into the night, and when Catherine falls asleep, Crawford opens up a little bit to Bubba about Pretorius and his kinky habits. And I do think it's important to discuss them here, because this is a film that takes on the very complex topic of kink and BDSM from a place that's unfortunately a little bit ignorant, so even though it does touch on some very real and very serious issues, it kind of does so by accident and with an attitude that's perhaps less than fully enlightened. So let's get into it, with the understanding that some of what we're talking about now is revealed and explored further over the course of the film. What's at least heavily implied is that Pretorius was fully or partially impotent, and that he took his sadism past the level of kink well into actual assault by ignoring safe words and pushing his torture into areas his submissives didn't consent to, because that was the only way he could get off. The woman at the beginning, the one we didn't actually see because the scene was cut, was getting a non-consensual tongue piercing, which is just, wow. That's some seriously heavy shit to drop in a movie like this, and I'm kind of glad it got cut. Pretorius wanted to stimulate the pineal gland and expand his senses because he believed that he would find newer, better sexual pleasures from them, and if Borden Kinky Top goes too far in the pursuit of hedonism and makes contact with another dimension where he's tortured and transformed, sounds like a familiar story. I'm just going to remind you that this film came out a month before The Hellbound Heart was published and a full year before it was turned into the movie Hellraiser. And look. There are some elements of this that are very much part and parcel of a whole series of pernicious myths about kink that would have been especially present in the 80s before the internet gave people a lot more resources to learn about BDSM in a non-judgmental context. It was generally believed that kink was the province of emotionally damaged, psychologically scarred individuals who were unable to enjoy quote-unquote normal sex like quote-unquote normal people. This is a distortion of the very real differentiation between kink and sex. A scene in BDSM doesn't need to involve sex of any kind, and indeed many asexual and aromantic people still enjoy several varieties of kink. But the fact that the two are different doesn't mean that one necessarily precludes or substitutes for the other, and it doesn't mean that you can't enjoy both. It's also a pretty nasty and pernicious myth that kink is a form of abuse, and that tops disregard consent and ignore safe words on a regular basis. Negotiation, communication, boundaries, and safe words are what make kink into kink, and if you're not practicing those things, you're not practicing BDSM, even if what you're doing bears a superficial resemblance to it. And Pretorius is being presented as a typical dominant, even though he's very much the kind of person who would get run out of most communities as soon as word got out of what he liked to do. Kink communities tend to be self-policing because there is no distinction between consensual and non-consensual violence in the eyes of the law, and most people would risk their reputations and even their livelihoods by testifying in court about their involvement in the practice. That said, this is where it does shade back into reality because unfortunately a self-policed community with no formal authority structure is vulnerable to social manipulation and predatory behavior, and Pretorius does behave like a real-life predatory dominant, even though I don't necessarily think Gordon, Paoli, and Yuzna had the background to fully understand what they were portraying here. He finds young and inexperienced women who may not recognize the red flags he's sending up. He manipulates them out of enforcing their boundaries as well as putting them into positions where they may not be able to do so physically, and he pushes them into doing things they didn't consent to or simply does those things without obtaining consent. Sadly, there are real guys out there like Pretorius, even though he's presented very much as a stereotype of the quote-unquote typical dominant, as that might have been understood by the vanilla culture of the time. As a result, I do kind of give this a pass on the is it unfair to kink, is it sex negative, because Pretorius is unfortunately a very real and believable character in that regard. Crawford gets the machines up and running, although without functioning computers, everything has to be operated manually with a single big switch, and after a series of warnings about staying completely still and quiet, he throws that switch and activates the resonator. This sound effect was sampled by the Beastie Boys for Intergalactic, although Turnabout is kind of fair play because this movie uses the Star Trek door swooshes every time someone walks through a self-opening door. It is immediately apparent, by the way, that absolutely no one has sufficiently prepared Bubba for what's about to happen because he's still asking if what appears when Crawford brings the resonator to life. Poor guy. We get the same bisexual lighting, the same clutching of foreheads, and Catherine at least appears to be experiencing sexual arousal at her newly stimulated senses, and then we see the floating eels and jellyfish, and Bubba is so startled he completely disregards the warning and gets a nasty chomp on the arm as a result. Crawford decides to switch the machine back off since no one seems to be able to follow the very simple rules he laid down, but just then Pretorius shows back up, fully reconstituted with a new, naked body and a lusty interest in Catherine. Crawford touches Pretorius, trying to determine whether what he's seeing is real or just a hallucination, but his fingers sink into the man's shoulder like it's wet clay, and Pretorius explains that his immortal mind constructed a new body out of the ectoplasmic creature that attacked and ate him. He transforms into something monstrous, reaching for Catherine, but Crawford manages to shut down the machine and banish him back to the realms beyond, leaving Bubba to lose his lunch on the attic floor. Catherine is invigorated and excited by the new possibilities of expanding the pineal gland, but both Bubba and Crawford are concerned about her heedless enthusiasm. She doesn't seem to be taking the danger seriously, and in fact she's talking about firing up the machine again to confirm their findings. Bubba mentions here that he was also physically aroused when the machine activated, causing Catherine to speculate that the pineal gland may have some role in regulating the sex drive. Catherine points out that the resonator can always be turned off as easily as it was turned on, and if there's a connection between the pineal gland and the hallucinations experienced by the mentally ill, then she might be able to make a breakthrough in curing schizophrenia. She confesses that she has a personal stake in it all. Her father was diagnosed with schizophrenia and died a vegetable in a mental hospital after the treatments the doctors used on him only made him progressively worse. But Bubba, as the representative of legal authority, puts his foot down. No more playing with the resonator. They're going to get some rest after their long night, and when they wake up, they're going to leave. They've proved what they needed to prove, the things Crawford saw are real, and that's all they came for. It's a nice idea in theory, but of course Catherine's not going to listen. Not only is she obsessed with using the device to prove her theories correct, but she's gotten a dose of the addictive pleasure the resonator brings with its stimulation of the pineal gland. She sneaks upstairs while the others sleep and turns the machine on, and when Crawford wakes up and tries to stop her, she attempts to seduce him instead. Which is Pretorius's cue to return, now in a more monstrous form. He grabs Catherine and uses her as a hostage to prevent Crawford from reaching the switch, and Crawford's forced to flee to the basement to try to turn it off at the breaker while Pretorius gropes and paws at the terrified psychiatrist. In another movie, this might feel like gratuitous sexualized peril, but here it does feel like a natural extension of the movie's themes and motifs. Pretorius is an embodiment of male sexual entitlement, both in life and in bizarre otherworldly afterlife, and he does see women as property to be used for his own gratification. It would be kind of gutless to pretend that wasn't true just because it's uncomfortable to watch here, and it's definitely presented as something awful and terrifying and cruel rather than titillating. Down in the basement, Crawford and Bubba discover that the resonator's vibrations have allowed a massive worm-like creature with a lamprey mouth to manifest, and it's between them and the circuit breaker. I do think there may be some minor titillating objectification going on in this movie in the way Ken Foree goes through this entire sequence in only a pair of skin-tight briefs, but he seems pretty comfortable with it, and at least it's equal opportunity objectification. Did I mention the bisexual lighting? Bubba stabs the worm with a butcher knife and disconnects the power, but not before Crawford and Catherine are both partially swallowed by their respective tormentors. Catherine comes back to herself repulsed and horrified by her experience, and Crawford has lost all the hair on his head and is now unresponsive to stimuli. Catherine decides to send the others away and perform the experiments herself, certain that it was the distraction of Crawford that led to the near catastrophe that just unfolded, but Bubba thinks she's just addicted to the pineal stimulation and needs another fix. I could point out some parallels to the pseudoscientific notion of sex addiction, but that would give the concept more credence than it deserves, and I really don't want to associate this awesome movie with it. Suffice it to say that it's just the same thinly veiled moral panic we've all seen before, and not a real physiological or psychological phenomenon. Neither is the resonator, of course, but at least nobody's pretending it is. Bubba pulls rank and decides they're all leaving immediately, and goes to get the van ready. While he's gone, Catherine discovers that the newly enlarged pineal gland and the enhanced sex drive it's given her has unlocked an interest in Pretorius's kinky dungeon, which Crawford's been forced to use as a bedroom this whole time in a humorous little touch. She puts on one of the leather fetish outfits she finds in the room, and I guess it's lucky Pretorius kept something in her size, and she sexually assaults the unconscious and unresponsive Crawford. Thankfully, Bubba comes back in and snaps her out of her fugue state before she can do anything, although not before she comes onto him as well. I feel like there's a version of this movie where they sort their shit out and become a polyamorous triad, and I'd be kind of okay with that. But as things stand, the resonator turns itself on, or as a reawakening Crawford puts it, he's trying to start the resonator from beyond. Bubba runs up and tries to smash it or shoot it or disconnect it, but he and the others are attacked by hordes of biting insectoid creatures, and even chopping through the power cable with an axe doesn't stop the machine. Bubba is eaten down to the bone by the bugs when he's caught in the beam of a flashlight that attracts them to him, and it's unfortunate that we once again don't get a black character who survives to the end of the movie, but at least he gets a great death. Praetorius then comes back out, less human than ever, planning to absorb Catherine directly into himself and merge their minds in a weird psychosexual union of dominant and submissive, and unfortunately Crawford's too busy undergoing his own physical transformation to stop him. His pineal gland directly emerges as a small tendril from his skull, just like Praetorius already has, and he perceives the world like the monster his old mentor has become. Luckily, Catherine manages to short out the resonator by spraying it with a fire extinguisher, ending the immediate threat. Unluckily, that leaves Crawford comatose and Bubba dead, and the sole survivor of the experience spouting a story that sounds an awful lot like what got Crawford committed in the first place. Back at the mental hospital, Block is somehow unconvinced by the tendril that briefly pokes out of the unconscious Crawford's forehead before retreating like a shy worm, and decides, purely out of spite and professional jealousy, to have Catherine committed and submit her to electroshock therapy. It's a steep dive into full villainy for the character, but Purdy Gordon sells it so hard that it just about works, even though it doesn't make a ton of sense. While all that's going on, Crawford wakes up and it's clear he's no longer fully human in ways he can never come back from. He sneaks out of his examining room while the guard is distracted hitting on the nurses and finds a bucket of brains in the pathology lab awaiting dissection. When Block returns looking for him, she finds him chowing down on them with dazed gusto, and although he briefly snaps back to his old self when confronted with the reality of what he's doing, it doesn't last, and his emerging pineal tendril sees Block as nothing more than his next meal. He chews his way straight through her eye and into her skull, and obviously the whole reason she's been made this unpleasant is so that we can be shocked and horrified by what Crawford's becoming while still retaining sympathy for him because obviously he only eats people we don't care about. The discovery of Block's body interrupts the electroshock just before it begins, and Catherine knocks out her orderly and escapes just as Crawford makes it down to the parking garage. Catherine goes back to the Praetorius house in Bubba's van to destroy the resonator, and Crawford steals an ambulance, killing the EMTs in the process and eating their brains as well, and gives chase. They both go up to the attic, although it appears that Catherine stopped off at home to change because she's now back to her nice professional tweeds, and Catherine plants a bomb directly on top of the machine with a 5-minute timer. No, I don't know where a disgraced psychiatrist and escaped mental patient finds a bomb. No, I don't know how she knows how to work with explosives. Look, Mr. Chekhov and his acts. Can't we just have one ticking time bomb to close out our movie out of nowhere in the third act without getting all logic-y here? Okay, man? Having set the bomb, Catherine tries to leave the house, but Crawford jumps her and drags her into Praetorius's dungeon and chains her up so that he can eat her beautiful, beautiful brains. But she bites his emerging pineal stalk clean off in a scene that apparently made actor Barbara Crampton decidedly uncomfortable due to the connotations of castration involved. Look, I'm not going to lie. The stalk looks disturbingly phallic, and the special effects crew said they realized a little too late just how much it looked like a dog's penis, and that snaps Crawford back to normal, at least mentally. Incidentally, I know I'm going to catch flack for this, but the pineal stalk would have been better as CGI. Tendrils and tentacles are always hard to pull off practically, and it never looks convincingly like anything but a wobbly latex puppet wiggling at the end of a prosthetic forehead. I think a CGI version would have moved more fluidly and realistically, and they maybe could have been a little more ambitious with it than they are here. The resonator reactivates as Crawford comes back to himself, and Praetorius takes advantage of Catherine's bondage to come after her again. But Crawford needles him with taunts about Praetorius' secret insecurities due to his impotence, suggesting that if they did merge minds, she'd see him for what he truly is and have nothing but contempt for him. It's enough to goad Praetorius into attacking Crawford instead, transforming into his final form as a bat-like creature and biting off Crawford's head, like a gingerbread man. Catherine sees the ill creatures again and uses their attraction to motion to get them to bite through her restraints. She then distracts them with a lit matchbook and runs away, only to find Crawford's corpse and the fully inhuman Praetorius. With nowhere left to go, she runs up into the attic, pursued by monsters beyond understanding, and now face to face with a resonator and a bomb that has only 30 seconds left before it blows. Praetorius catches up to her, but just as he's about to grab and devour her, Crawford emerges from the body, his own immortal mind refusing to be subjugated to his old mentor. Their shared body twists and transforms again and again as the two fight for dominance, and Catherine takes the opportunity to just leap out the attic window seconds before the bomb goes off and destroys the forbidden discovery forever. Catherine drops two stories to the ground, her leg shattered so badly that the bone is sticking out. And I commend the film for its attention to grotesque realism all the way to the very end, when it could have just given us Barbara Crampton lying on the ground acting hurt. The neighbors come out, including our busybody from the beginning and her little dog Bunny, and when she asks Catherine what happened, she chokes out, "It ate him," before scream laughing in a ferocious, virtuoso final moment from Barbara Crampton that will never not send shivers down my spine. Seriously, she commits to the bit so damn hard here that I honestly think it's one of my favorite endings in all of horror, and it is entirely down to her performance decisions. This is why she's a legend, people. Watch this scene and try to tell me I'm wrong. And will I hang on to this movie? Oh, hell yes. This is everything I love about horror. A cosmic nightmare of gruesome physical transformations that isn't afraid to delve into the kinky and the perverse along the way. It's got mesmerizing performances from some of my favorite actors. The aesthetic is gloriously lurid and grotesque and lit with a neon glow that feels decadent and terrifying at the same time. I mean, seriously, I cannot find enough good things to say about this. If it's at all something you feel like you can handle, and I do get that the subject matter is kind of intense, so you should probably know what you're in for going in, then I think you kinda owe it to yourself to see this. Reanimator gets all the hype, but this is the movie that goes full cosmic nightmare, and it's worth every penny you spend on it. Although, did I mention that right now it's on Tubi for free? And if you want to talk about that final screaming laugh, the absolutely astonishing revelation that Neil Adams was the concept artist for this film, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as Half Price Horror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, I know I said we were done with Larry Cohen's It's Alive trilogy, and technically, that's true. But as with all great 70s horror movies, this one got a remake in the aughts. So let's close out our look at the franchise with the 2009 reboot from director Josef Ruznak, the identically titled, but otherwise utterly dissimilar, It's Alive. See you then.